listener production.
Okay, are you recording?
Welcome, great people. You are listening to episode 186 of the Howie Games Part A, featuring the voice of cycling, Matthew Keenan.
The spectators are banging the barriers, and they're banging them for the Western Australian, Jai Hindley, in his first appearance at the Tour de France. Hindley's the hero, and Hindley is in yellow. Extraordinary.
That voice of cycling line, I've used it before, way back on episode 31, to introduce the great man, Phil Liggett. So, Matt had to take over from the guru, Phil. Wow. Like being asked to take over from Richie Beno in cricket commentary, Murray Walker in Formula One commentary, massive shoes to fill, no pressure. But Matt, in his own methodical, calm way, has done it brilliantly. He's done it seamlessly.
So many lost and left behind, and no one seemed to care. Those who should seems like they're blind, pretending they're not there. Can't they see they hold the key? Could make things better if they try. Oh my Jaja, tell me why won't they open up their eyes?
As a result, Matt gets to call the events in the world of cycling the Giro d'Italia, the Vuelta d'Espana, and the big puppy, the Tour de France, both men and women's. All, of course, on SBS, who do an elite job with cycling. They've been doing it for years. They do it better than anyone else. Keep an eye out for the Tour on SBS. They always dominate the space. Let's get to it. For those that like stories of people who have a dream, set in place a plan to achieve that dream, then through hard work, live out that very dream. Enjoy the story of Matthew Keenan, a man living his best life.
So when you search and then you find and know just where to go, and thoughts that once used to cloud your mind, you see clearly and now you know. Mystery, what is to be revealed in King Selassie I. Come on children, trot with me, we want to reach Mount Zion I.
There are certain iconic sporting events that you just need to watch. The Monaco Grand Prix, you need to watch it. Wimbledon final, you need to watch it, men and women's. World Cup football, for me, you got to watch the final. And one that has always been on my list is the Tour de France. Forever been on SBS, and it's one of those events you just need to watch. So imagine being the voice of that. Imagine being the voice of an iconic event like that. Well, that is what this man is, Matt Keenan. Welcome to the Howie Games. Can you believe you are the voice of one of the most iconic sporting events in the world?
And in the shadow of the great Phil Liggett, who was the soundtrack.
It's like taking over from Richie, which we'll get to. No pressure.
No. Richie's the soundtrack to our summer. Mm. We're the same sort of age. Yeah. We were growing up as kids. And Phil was the soundtrack to cycling. Just that iconic voice.
Just to give people an idea, before we get into this in your backstory, give me a brief rundown of the cycling events you will be calling in 2023.
So the average year would include doing the Bay Cycling Classic, yep, in Geelong, then up to Ballarat for the National Championships, across to Adelaide for the Tour Down Under, back to Geelong for the Cadel Evans Great Ocean Road Race. That's January covered. In February, traditionally, it would be the Tour of Oman and start at Bianca, which is a one-day race from Italy. March is an eight-day race from France, Paris-Nice. Then in April is every weekend, one of the big one-day classics. It goes from Gent-Wevelgem, Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, Amstel Gold Race, Flèche-Wallonne, Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
Have a listen to this, man. We're only in April.
May is the Giro d'Italia. So tennis has got its four Grand Slams. Yep. Cycling's got its three Grand Tours. The Tour of Italy, or the Giro d'Italia, same format as the Tour de France. So that's May taken care of. And that's 21 stages, two rest days. It's across four weekends. So four rounds of football, essentially. Then in June, you've got the Criterium du Dauphiné, which is on right now. That's an eight-day race, key preparation race for the Tour de France.
Which you're doing now.
Which
so,
I'm doing
so let people
right
know
now.
What time are you on air tonight?
11 o'clock. Off air at about 1:30 a.m. home to try and put myself in a carbohydrate coma. So I try and load up. You know, you have too much to do and you fall asleep on the couch at night.
Yep.
Well, I try and do that at about 3 a.m. in the morning.
Hard getting home after work and going to sleep. So then, and then we get to...
Then we get to the tour.
Yep.
Then we're off for the tour. We're there for around about 5 weeks. So I leave on the 25th of June, get home on the 3rd of August. Got the men's race, then the women's race. Then come home, 2 weeks not doing much. actually, not this year, we have the World Championships. So get home on a Wednesday, and then the World Championships start on the Saturday. So we're broadcasting the World Championships for a week. They're in Glasgow,
okay,
in Scotland. And then a week after that finishes, we do the Vuelta a España, which is the Tour of Spain. Again, exact same format as the Tour de France, 21 days, so 3 full weeks across 4 weekends. And that kind of takes us to the end of September. And then October, we're heading to the beach.
So that's extraordinary, and you'll get to, as this discussion goes on, my admiration for this man. Because I've always thought, like, I look at horse racing and I think, how on earth do they do that? Like, 9-10 race card, looking at the colours, the study that must be required, and we'll talk about your study. I've always thought probably horse racing and cycling for me are the two hardest, because how many riders are on a stage of the tour typically?
176. So there's 22 teams, 8 riders each.
So there's 176 gurus you need to know about, and a typical stage goes, well, how many hours?
5 hours, 5.5 hours, okay, worth of broadcast.
So for people that are not familiar with the tour, brilliant event, watch it on SBS. It's like I said, it is such a good event. But for on a flat stage, you might have our man Matty talking with nothing basically happening for 5 hours and 15 minutes. And then you get the last 1,500 metres where it's all happening. And if you get that wrong, that's all anyone remembers. So it's a hell of a job you have, my man, a hell of a job.
Those stages, there's some of them where they roll out of the neutral zone and the flag drops and you know it's going to be a day for the sprinters and no one wants to go on the breakaway. And then they let one or two guys roll up the road.
But you know they're getting caught.
You know they're getting caught. And they're going to be out there for four and a half hours on their own. And I'm like, I've got something to say about everybody, but I need more than one. I need more than two. Give me something to talk about. It was one stage famously in the tour a few years ago, and I was calling with Robbie McEwen, and that thing, the flag drops. They roll out, and this guy, Guillaume van Kiesbroek, rolls off the front. And I'm like, come on, somebody go out there with him. We need more than one person to talk about. Well, he was out there on his own, and we knew plenty about him. In fact, at the Tour Down Under earlier that year, Robbie had had his family in the car with him at the Tour Down Under in Adelaide, so he knew a fair bit. This guy's grandfather had won a world title in the 1960s. He'd previously ridden with one of the big teams. He was now with one of the smaller teams. We had a bit to say, but it was about a 15-minute podcast. It wasn't 5 hours worth of Tour de France coverage of one guy.
How long was he on his own for?
It was a 204-kilometre stage. He was out on his own for 195.
So of the 195K, on percentage, what percentage of the broadcast is just on him on his bike as opposed to being back with the peloton?
Probably 45%.
So you've got 90 k's worth of talking about old mate.
Yeah.
But then you've got the churches and you've got the beautiful scenery, which I will speak about.
Okay.
We will speak about. Let's not jump ahead of me. We met,
which
you didn't think I'd remember.
I didn't.
In Traralgon.
We did.
At a bike race. So Channel 10 must have had it.
Yeah.
It was the first bike race, maybe the only bike race I've worked on.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that says anything about my broadcasting, but was that the Herald Sun Tour?
Correct. Yeah, right. It was. So it was 2008. So that was just after I'd done the tour for the second time.
Yep.
But I was still working in a normal job at that point.
Yes.
So I was taking leave without pay to go and cover bike races and working at WorkSafe Victoria, doing media and comms for WorkSafe. And you were a rising star. You'd
land.
It was a good rise.
slow, in my eyes, thank you, Matt.
You were a rising star.
Thank you.
And I remember standing there, you were doing a hosting.
Yes.
And I thought, that's a fair benchmark. You looked really relaxed. You were just comfortable in your own skin. And I looked at the way you performed that as doing that hosting as a role model of something to follow, because I was in Phil's shadow and probably forever will be, but in Phil's shadow. And there was no point me trying to be a cover band. There's no point being Baba.
No.
You got to be your own original ABBA.
Yeah.
And I was watching you and you weren't the same as anybody else that was doing hosting. You were Mark Howard. And at that point, I figured, I just got to be Matt Keenan. And people will like it or they won't. And I can't try and pretend to be anybody else. Just be yourself. Well, so I thought you were fantastic.
I didn't know that. That must have been my one good day and I appreciate it. That's very kind of you. And then we spoke since then. Funnily enough, because Phil was coming on the podcast. It's got to be 4 or 5 years ago, and you were the first person I rang to get information about the great Phil Liggett, who it turns out was a zookeeper in his younger in his younger life. Mate, I've got so many questions for you about preparation and what a day on the tour is. When this goes to air, the tour will be in full swing on SBS. like I say, you grow up, I grew up, you know, it was Mike Tomalara's hosting and Phil calling, and then Gabriel Gattai would pop up with the cooking. So it's such an iconic event on SBS, but I want to follow your journey of how you got there. You're from a big family.
One of seven kids.
But one of seven.
I've got twin brothers below me and twin sisters above me. So I've got like the most extreme case of middle child syndrome.
I'm doing
a job that's just screaming out for attention. Absolutely. Yeah, so I'm one of seven kids. I've got four older sisters, two younger brothers, and everybody played sport. And Mum was the person that was really into sport, even more so than Dad.
Huh.
And if she was still with us today and she was out watching her grandkids play, she'd be the parent that the umpire would stop to talk to.
Right.
She was pretty vocal from the sideline.
Right.
Whereas Dad was really quiet and just got on with it. But, you know, I was the kid that would watch the Herald Shield on Saturday morning with Sandy Roberts and Bobby Skilton commentating. That had finished at 7:30 and then the Thunderbirds had come on. Wasn't interested in the Thunderbirds. So I'd be out the door down the park and it would be me playing for Carlton, be Kenny Sheldon,
Are you a Carlton fan?
Sorry about that.
I'm sorry about that for you.
And then I would kick 5-4, I'd win the game. Collingwood would lose by a couple of points and I'd be commentating to myself.
Right, so even at that young age?
You did it.
Well, no, but I fell into it though. My son does it, but I only think because of what I didn't have, certainly have an ambition at all.
I didn't have an ambition to commentate.
But you did it.
I had an ambition to be commentated on.
Yeah, true. I was probably commentating on the Chief, Jason Dunstall kicking the winning goal in a Hawthorn Premiership. You're right about that. But what was your first bike?
Like my first bike, I remember at Christmas time, written a letter to Santa to get a bike. And I woke up at about 4 o'clock in the morning, commando crawl out through the living room, and I could see two yellow bikes. And I started bawling my eyes out. And then Mum comes in, "What's wrong?" I said, Santa got Peter and David a bike and Santa didn't get me a bike. And Mum turns the light on. There was two yellow bikes and mine was black. So I got a BMX for Christmas. It was fantastic. That was the first bike that I got.
And was it for you, for so many kids growing up, the bike is freedom?
Well, it's your chance to get away from Mum and Dad, isn't it? Yeah, it gives you the ability. You could ride to tennis, you could ride to football, ride to a friend's house. We had a good parkland near our place in Rosanna. It used to be an old golf course that got converted into a park and an estate. And yeah, it was exploring the neighbourhood. And that's part of the journey for me into cycling, is it was a chance to also explore the rest of the world.
Mm.
And, you know, I loved all sports, but before SBS had the tour, it was on Channel 9 and it would be on a Saturday afternoon on Wild World of Sports.
Ah.
And, you know, even great Billy Birmingham, it's in the 12th man. You know, that ball chafing cycling races on a game, the Tour de France.
Yeah.
Remember that?
I do.
Great.
I do.
So, because it was on 9.
Yeah.
It was on Channel 9. And Greg LeMond was this amazing athlete from the United States, and it was relatable because he spoke English and did these great interviews after all the stages. And John Tesh was doing the voiceover, and then Phil and Paul were doing the commentary. And I can remember it, you know, will Pedro Delgado sprout wings in the Pyrenees like he did last year? Or will it be the bespectacled Parisian Laurent Fignon that flies away with the Maillot Jaune? But it blows an ill wind for the rest of the peloton when Greg LeMond rides the Tour de France. I was in. And I wanted to go and explore all these places. Like I'd gone from, you know, living in Rosanna to exploring Heidelberg to being in Rosanna and wanting to get on my bike and explore Alpe d'Huez and explore Luz Ardiden, explore all these amazing places overseas.
But as a competitor.
But as a competitor, not as a commentator. So I had this dream of being a professional cyclist. And if Greg LeMond was going to be the first American to win the Tour, Matt Keenan was going to be the first Australian to win the Tour. As a 14-year-old.
His name in French means the world, and this is the world of Greg LeMond in Paris today, the first American ever to pull on a winner's yellow jersey in the Tour de France.
But Cadell pipped you, but you can still be the second. Well, you're leaving your run a touch late, Matthew.
A touch late.
I looked back through the winners before I chatted with you, and I as a casual viewer, and I'll be honest, mate, I watched it stage in stage. It was a time when I was single and I used to love land. So that was when I was obsessed with the Tour de France. But so I didn't realise that Greg was the first basically non-European winner of the whole operation and then obviously went and dominate. It's bizarre now, isn't it, when you look back on those 7 years of lands, like in Wikipedia, there's just asterisks. There's no winner.
It's weird, huh?
It's bizarre.
Yeah, it is really weird. And there's
really
other guys that are still on the list that were clearly cheating their backside off.
Yes.
Like Bjarne Riis, who won the Tour in 96, his nickname was Mr. 60%. Now, 60%, that refers to your hematocrit.
Right.
And it's EPO that raises your hematocrit. And most people, their average hematocrit is it's around like sort of 42-ish percent, something like that. They brought in a rule in cycling that if it, because they couldn't get a test for EPO, that if it was over 50, it was deemed unsafe, so you couldn't race. Can't prove that you've been cheating, but you can't race until it gets back below 50.
And he was a 60%
and
man.
He was, his nickname was Mr. 60%.
Okay.
His blood was like soup, but he's still on the list. And Jan Ullrich, who won the tour before Lance, and Marco Pantani, who won it the year before. Pantani got plenty of convictions for doping. Tragically, he's now dead. Jan Ullrich was also doping, but his name is on the list. So what do you do with those guys if you don't treat them the same as Armstrong?
And that's what captured me was Armstrong versus Ullrich, and they would just go on that breakaway up the mountain, and you could just see them neither giving an inch, and then typically at one moment Lance would be half a wheel ahead and then a full wheel ahead and then a bike ahead. He just saw this man physically crack on the bike behind him, and obviously everything that went on with doping and stuff, but I found that captivating. That, and that was pre-helmet. They had those little caps on, and it was – that really captured me, that whole setup.
Yeah, whereas when I was falling in love with it, you know, Laurent Fignon had the long, blonde, flowing locks. You know, LeMond was the first one to wear the fantastic Oakley glasses. Phil Anderson had a big ponytail as well. You know, Pedro Delgado always had this exasperated expression on his face. And you felt like you got more of a connection with the athletes than probably you do now.
Which is, I guess, a reflection on modern sport. So you're starting cycling. What's your first race you've gone in as the first Australian Tour de France winner prodigy on the way up?
So it was November of 1990. I was 15 years of age and I was
this is why you're good at your job. Do you know what day it was in November? What the temperature? Well, let's just say November 1990.
It was the Thursday.
Of course it was.
After Melbourne Cup.
After the Melbourne Cup, okay.
Because that was the first track race for that summer season.
Right.
So I went down there as a 15-year-old in the under-17s race, and there was three races that night.
Whereabouts?
Northcote.
Northcote?
Yeah.
Oh, on the velodrome?
Yeah, it was outdoor velodrome then, Kane Memorial Park.
Yeah.
It's now an indoor velodrome. Anyway, it was old concrete outdoor velodrome, and first race, last.
Out of how many?
Oh, it would have been a dozen. Okay. Second race?
Yeah.
Last.
Okay.
Third race? I was consistent.
You come last.
But this didn't deter me.
Of course not.
Because the Tour de France isn't one on a velodrome.
No.
It's one in the mountains.
Right.
So I'm driving home in silence with my mother, and all I was thinking to myself is, how good is my autobiography going to be from last to winning the Tour de France?
Champs-Élysées, say, how did this start? I came last.
Yeah, that's right.
I love your positive mindset.
Yeah, I'd just read Bernard Hinault's book, The Frenchman That Won the Tour de France 5 Times, and he won his first race. And I thought, my story is going to be so much better when I go from last to first. People are going to relate to me. They're not going to relate to Bernard Hinault. Eventually, I got a little bit better. And
you got a lot better. Let's be honest. You got a lot better.
I got a fair bit better. Got onto the road, won a few races, you know, rode for the state at national championships, those sorts of things. And as a 20-year-old, I went to Europe for the first time. And
to cycle?
To race. I rode for a small Dutch team. I got my backside handed to me.
So are you getting paid to do this?
I didn't get a wage, but I had all expenses covered.
Okay.
So it was.
But they were next level, were they, these blokes?
Yeah. So it was sort of top-end amateur level, just before that step to go, kind of like playing in the VFA.
Okay.
Instead of playing in the AFL.
Yep.
That type of thing. Best result I got was 7th. And I'd mucked around at school prior to that. Like, I was the kid that wagged school, but instead of chasing girls or experimenting with booze, I'd wag school, hide my bag in the Rosanna Parklands, and go training.
And you still came last.
Oh, that was after last. Last motivated the training.
Okay. So you'd wag school to go and train on your bike.
Yeah, so I flunked school.
This is good in the autobiography on the way to winning the tour. That's
a
good story.
It's a great
story.
Relatable. Exactly. So at the end of year 9, the school that I went to thought it would be best that I pursue my academic career elsewhere. Then I went from Parade College, then I ended up at McLeod Tech.
Oh, because you were bringing down the...
There was no good for the numbers. I was no good for the numbers.
So a statistical poor performer.
Exactly. You've got to cut them loose every now and then.
Right.
And I was cut loose. And I went to McLeod Tech, which was, local tech school.
Yep.
A lot of the catchment area was the West Heidelberg Commissioner Houses and so on. So going from Parade College, you know, an all-boys school, and turning up on my first day at McLeod Tech in shorts with shaved legs. It wasn't a good start. It was, you know, it was in 1990, that wasn't the warmest welcome. Anyway, I mucked around through school. I finished year 12, but I didn't do it, if you know what I mean. Like, I didn't get any results. I just didn't hand in the work. Didn't get stuff done. So I didn't get a VCE certificate.
Oh, you actually didn't?
No.
Right.
No. Because I was going to, Howie.
Didn't matter.
I was going to win the Tour de France.
Of course you were.
And we've spoken about this.
We did, numerous times.
So, and then as a 20-year-old, eventually I went to Europe and I got absolutely pole-ex. Best result was a 7th place finish. I came home and I thought, all right, maybe I'm not winning the Tour. Maybe I can get to the Tour, but I've got to have a plan B. So as a 21-year-old, I went back to TAFE and I did VCE. And I set myself a bunch of targets whilst racing in Australia. Had to finish in the top 10 of what was the equivalent to the National Road Series. Had to finish top 10 at the National Championships and win a couple of races at a certain level.
To continue to pursue
cycling.
To continue
to chase the dream.
Okay.
Otherwise, I've got to actually go to university and get a real job.
Well, that's a for a young man, that's a very disciplined approach to it all.
Yeah. So I achieved those things. In what was the equivalent to the National Road Series then, I finished 5th. At the National Championships, I was 6th at the National Championships, which was a 200K road race around Centennial Park in Sydney. And significantly, I was 1st in the under-23s. And that was the first year that cycling went from amateurs and pros to under-23 category and elite. So I was the first under-23 at the National Championships. And I thought maybe I'm a chance to be on the national team to go to the World Championships because there were 6 riders to go on the team. But I didn't get selected. And at the time, I was disappointed, obviously. But on reflection, I look at the other athletes that were eligible in my age group to go for the under-23s. So we had Cadell Evans, Brad McGee, who, you know, Olympic Games gold medalist, yellow jersey, the Tour de France. We had Brett Lancaster, Olympic gold medalist.
See, I've heard of these.
You hadn't heard of me.
No, not yet.
No.
Who else you got?
We had Baden Cook, green jersey, the Tour de France. Who else did we have in that grouping? We had David McKenzie, I think, was eligible stage winner at the Giro d'Italia eventually. So at the time, I was disappointed, but on reflection, the selectors made the right call by not taking me.
Back to Matty shortly. Next up on the show, a delightful man. Delightful. A superstar of his sport. A man who's broken Aussie hearts too many times to remember or admit. I speak of Stuart Broad.
Ultimately, it was about building the confidence by trying to get rid of the fear of failure. And that is one of the hardest things to do in professional sport. The fear of failure is there at all times. It's such a difficult thing to try and remove. And they've done it. I've not heard them talk about the result once in a whole year. So never is it, we should have won that game. We need to win this game, or we got to make sure we can't lose this game. The result doesn't matter. It's all about entertaining and the process. So without question, the first role of our group is to entertain the people that are buying a ticket, listening on the radio, watching on the telly. Your job is to entertain. And that means you can do that. You can do that in 8 balls. You can get 20 off 8 balls, hit 2 massive sixes, come in and you'll get a tap on the back saying, God, like, oh, do you see the crowd there? Do you see the crowd jumping for joy?
Wow.
Instead of, you know, getting 100 and everyone would tap you on the back.
If you are an Aussie, put your preconceived ideas to the side. Stuart is a beauty. I cannot wait for you all to hear it. That's Stuart Broad next up on the show. Let's get back to Matt.
So is that sort of, I'm not going to make it cycling at this point?
No, I'm not going to make it. So I ticked the boxes.
Confidence is impressive.
Ticked the boxes. I did okay at school when I actually attended and handed in the work and I got a reasonable result. Got myself into uni, Bachelor of Arts, Public Relations. But I ticked the boxes and I was still chasing the cycling dream. So I got a spot on a small French team. So
Are you getting paid now?
No.
Still expenses?
Still expenses covered.
What's the name of the team?
Club Olympic Multisport Argenteuil.
Okay.
A bit of a mouthful. A small team just on the outskirts of Paris.
And so are they just racing bike races in France?
But predominantly in France.
Okay.
Yeah, a little bit in Belgium, a little bit in Holland, a little bit in Germany.
Where are you living?
I'm living in a studio apartment with a guy from Poland and a guy from Portugal, and we've got 2 bunk beds.
Still thinking you can potentially one day compete in the Tour de France?
Still chasing the dream.
Okay.
So I set myself, okay, I've got to win 4 races in Europe to justify continuing to chase that dream.
Oh, on your schedule?
On my schedule. So I'm now 22 years of age and I'm on the schedule.
Time's ticking. Tick, 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 tick.
And I've been there for 6 weeks and nobody has spoken English to me except for the Portuguese guy and the Polish guy. All the French guys haven't spoken English to me.
And on your team?
On my team. And my French was essentially non-existent at that time. And there was no Duolingo app to learn it. I was trying to learn it off cassettes, but it wasn't going so well. And I'm in this race, and it's point A to point B. There's eight of us in the breakaway. We get to the finishing circuits. There's six of us. Then there's four of us. Then there's two of us, 5Ks to go. And it's me and one of my teammates. And we're working turns. It's 30% easier sitting behind someone. He rolls past me, and he says, "I want to win." He speaks English.
He's unveiled his big statement.
I said, "I want to win too. My family is here. My grandparents are here. I want to win."
Put the guilt trip on you.
I said, he didn't understand this much English. I said, "I flew Garuda, Indonesia. I really want to win." And then he stopped working with me. So he's sitting behind me and we're going to get caught. Neither of us are going to win. I said, "Okay, you win, but I get the prize money for first and second."
This is a negotiation on the road.
At 180 beats per minute, 45 Ks an hour.
So, and you're going to take first and second prize
we're
money?
He's going to win.
Yep.
But I get the prize money for first and second. He goes, "Okay, deal." And then we're working turns. We're coming down towards the last kilometre and I'm like, I might not get another chance. And there's one corner with about 600 metres to go and I wasn't particularly good at getting through the corners, but this guy was particularly bad. And I just said, "You know, you take us to the corner, then I lead you out from there, we'll be fine." And we're coming to that corner and I'm just thinking, might not get another chance. So I've laid off him a little bit coming into the corner and I've dived up the inside. I've come out of the corner. I've looked across my shoulder. I'm three lengths clear. I ain't waiting now. And I just took off and I kept going and I won.
In front of his grandparents?
In front of his family. But I flew Garuda, remember?
Of course.
And I won the race and he's come across the line and he was speaking really loud, fluent, fast French at this point. He didn't speak English to me for the rest of the season.
Right.
But I won. And I spoke to, straight away, I spoke with the team manager about this is what happened. He goes, "No problem. That's all cool. We won. You did the right thing. You've got to try and win." And then I won one more race. I had a second place finish, but I didn't win the four races that I'd set for myself. So then I came home and at 22 years of age, the dream was over. And at 23, I went to university and started the journey to try and get a real job.
Was it difficult to put that behind you or you just...
Absolutely it was.
So what's that moment like when you realise your dream's not going to be fulfilled?
Oh, you hear about a lot of athletes that have a really successful career and it comes to a close. There's thousands more that have had the dream and the dream never even gets fulfilled. And you've got that sense of being a failure because you haven't achieved your dream. The comfort that I take is that I know why I didn't make it. And it wasn't a lack of effort. I worked my backside off. It wasn't a lack of opportunity. There was no political elements within the sport working against me. I was not good enough. That is the sole reason I didn't make it. And I can sleep at night with that because I gave myself every chance to get there and I just wasn't good enough.
And I obviously can't question your heart at all, but you organised Tommy to bring your bike in today and you were going to ride in, but then we're excited to see this bike and the lead commentator of the tour is going to be one of these $15,000 bikes. But just a bit cold outside, Matty.
So it was a bit windy. It was headwind home.
Right, so you didn't want to ride in.
I had it.
Mate, maybe that's why you're not on the top of the podium, mate.
I've been exposed.
Maybe that's why you're not.
Canal would have ridden in.
Yeah, he would have. I see him down where I live. He would have ridden in. So you go and get like a normal job?
Yeah, I got a normal job.
Doing?
I was working in the marketing at Sport and Recreation Victoria. It was my first real job after university. I hadn't quite finished uni, but I was just volunteering, trying to get some work experience. And a job popped up at Sport and Recreation Victoria. Justin Madden had just been appointed as the Minister for Sport. And as a Carlton supporter,
man.
I thought that was pretty cool. And I was working on the soccer matches or the football matches that were part of the Olympics that were in Melbourne. So there were 13 games during the Sydney Olympics that were in Melbourne. So I got to do the marketing and the PR and all those sorts of things around that.
So what was the first thing you ever commentated?
The first thing I ever commentated on was actually a bike race. So then that was sort of like 99, 2000. And then I still wanted to be involved in cycling. I still did some club races and, you know, row with my mates and so on. And then an ad popped up to be a co-commentator, voluntary gig, at what was then, I think it was Vodafone Arena.
Which an is ad? Now,
an ad within the Victorian Cycling website.
Okay.
So it was to be the co-commentator with this guy, Stewie Doyle, who is this iconic voice of track cycling in particular in Australia. One of the best venue commentators I've ever heard. And even Phil Liggett would say that about Stewie Doyle. Absolute icon within the cycling community. And Ed popped up to commentate with him. I thought that'd be a fun way to stay involved in the sport. So I applied for it and I got called in for an interview. And I'm not getting paid. There's eight people around the table doing this interview. And as I'm walking in, this guy, Robert Crowe, is walking out. Now, Crowe, he won Australian National Road title, Australian Time Trial title, represented Australia at the Olympics in Barcelona in 92. He's on his way out. I've walked in. The first thing one of the guys says to me is, well, we've just had Robert Crowe in here. He was a much better bike rider than you. What can you possibly offer that he can't? That's a fair question. A
very sharp question.
I couldn't carry his bags as a bike rider. He was far superior to me. And at that point, Phil Anderson had done a little bit of commentating on things like the Sun Tour and so on, and he was Australia's greatest road cyclist at that point. And I said, yeah, spot on. Crowe's much better than me. Who's a better bike rider, Phil Anderson or Paul Sherwin? Oh, Phil Anderson's the greatest cyclist we've ever had. He's way better than Paul Sherwin. I said, yeah, totally. I agree. Who's a better commentator, Paul Sherwin or Phil Anderson? And at that point, Stewie Doyle, the main commentator, hadn't said anything, but he heard that answer. And Stewie was, you know, not a great cyclist himself, just a good club cyclist. So he related to that. And he said, okay, let's give you both a go. So we both commentated. And again, it was
on the same night?
On the same night.
Were you filling the role of special comments, for want of a better term?
Correct.
So your man Stewie's calling the action, and he's then the he's lead. Pausing and you're
and it's Crowe
filling
and
in
I
the colour.
Okay. Having to go. So he'd do run one race, I'd do one race.
Right.
And then
Australian Idol stuff.
It was basically exactly the voice Australian Idol, whatever you like. And I can remember some of the junior races. There was a young Lee Howard who was dominating the under 15s. He's from Geelong and went on to have a really successful pro career. And then there was a handicap race, Melbourne Cup on wheels, and Richard England, he won the race. He was riding off 80 metres. And I remember saying his name, Richard England, better known as Dick London or something along those lines. And it got a bit of a laugh of the crowd. And I'm like, I'm in. How good's this? You know, can you remember?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a buzz.
Yeah, it is. Of course it is.
And getting audience feedback.
Especially in venue like that.
Yeah, so good. And there was about 4,000 people in there. So that's the first time I've commentated and I got a positive reaction. And at that point, I thought, maybe there's more than one way to skin a cat. I wasn't good enough to ride the tour. Maybe I can get there as a commentator. So that was the day the dream was born to actually become a commentator.
And then off the top of your head, how long did you spend with a real job doing this with no pay?
5 years.
5 years. So you called 5 years of races without getting paid.
Essentially, yep. So I went from that, I went and volunteered at every track race I could. I'd go to Warrigal and commentate on under 17 carnival, and it's only mum and dad there that are watching. And you're trying to make a B-grade under 15s race entertaining that's 10 laps of people going around in a circle. Great training ground. I then did every Saturday morning, I did the Puma Sports Show. Have you ever heard of John Forbes?
Mm.
Yeah, so Forbes,
famous
legend, passed away recently. Mm. He had this sports show out in the western suburb, so I went out with him each Saturday morning and did the Puma Sports Show. And it was good that it wasn't on cycling. So there was horse racing. There
was it radio? Talking.
Yeah, yeah.
Radio, okay.
Community radio. Ah. So that was a voluntary gig. Wrote articles for cycling websites, etc. Tried to have a go at everything. And then I pitched a show to SEN. Called First Off the Bike. So it was cycling and also triathlon and got that up. We weren't getting paid. We were kind of bringing in our own sponsors to cover our time on air, all those sorts of things. Mm. It was when SEN was just starting. And then I'd volunteered to go to the Bay Cycling Classic, which is a 5-day criterium series at the start of the season. And Phil Liggett is commentating on that. So I've paid for my accommodation and I'm doing the support race. And then the elites come on and I hand the microphone over to Phil and I'm down by the barriers with everybody else. Did that year one. Year two, I'm back out there again, paying my own way, volunteering to commentate on the support races. And the last day, Phil says, why don't you come up on the stage and join me?
The great man.
So he invited me up because he'd been watching me throughout the past 2 years. And that was when I started to develop that connection with Phil. And I worked with him and I made sure that, you know, if there was a rider, because they're all local riders, how can he recognize everybody over here? If he wasn't sure who it was, instead of me jumping over the top on the microphone, I'd point to the guy on the start list so he could say who it was.
So you're making your fellow commentator look as good as possible.
It was the best way, wasn't it?
Of course it is.
Yeah.
It's the only way.
Absolutely. And then I figured, well, I need a relationship with Phil and I need a relationship with Paul Sherwin. So with the program that I had on SEN, I rang, got in contact with Paul.
For those not aware, Phil and Paul for years, Richie and Tony, like they're the voices, they're the combination that you want to listen to. They are the Tour de France.
Yeah, exactly. And they're the only two people that had commentated Tour de France free-to-air anywhere in the world in English for stage finishes.
It's going to be desperate. The seconds are there. But this time, Oscar, they're in your favour. You still lead the Tour de France, and we're talking 4 or 5 seconds.
We are talking seconds as the next man to come in is Cadel Evans. He, too, is trying to stop the clock. Look at her face. He's not happy with this one this afternoon. Here is Rasmus.
So, absolute icons. And Paul had ridden the Tour 7 times, so he was the ex-athlete and Phil was the commentator. But I knew I needed a good relationship with Paul. So I had to try and get a connection with him. So I got his contact details from Phil. I contacted Paul and did a This Is Your Lifestyle interview on SEN. And one of the books I read when I was a bit younger was Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. And the best way to get on side with people is ask them about themselves. Because for most of us, it's our favourite topic. I'm loving this interview, Howie. It's great.
That's why the show works, because you ask one question and then the guest just bangs on for an hour. No, it's perfect. But right. No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, so then I built a rapport with Paul. We'd never actually met in person. And then after I'd done that interview with him, which was about him, I then contacted him once a month or when there was a key race to get him to do a preview with me on the Tour de France or other key races and so on. And then eventually, you know, I was working on like the Herald Sun Tour. I did that in 2005.
You're just taking holidays. You've got your job.
Holidays leave without pay.
You reckon he's happy? That was perfect timing from Hilton Clark. Second wheel into the corner and he managed to pick up the win, only just holding off the Tasmanian and Matt Goss.
And then in 2007, I was sitting in the office and at about 5:30 in the afternoon.
In your normal job?
In my normal job, I got an email from ASO. This is the company that owns the Tour de France and a whole bunch of other big races as well. And there's a race called the Tour of Qatar. And it's clashing with the Tour of California. Phil and Paul are commentating on the Tour of California. So ASO have asked Phil and Paul, you're not available. We need a commentator for the Tour of Qatar. Who do you recommend? They recommended me. So the company that owns the Tour de France offered me a gig to go and commentate on the Tour of Qatar without ever having heard me. Did not know who
just
on earth
on
I was.
Just on their recommendation.
Just on their recommendation.
How to win friends and influence people.
It's a contact sport.
Yeah.
So they are the two most important relationships that I've ever had in my working life, without question. So I get that email. I walk into the boss. Can I have another couple of weeks leave without pay? And then I went over the Tour of Qatar and they said to me, this is an audition to be the lead up commentator to Phil and Paul at the Tour de France, because for the last 2 years they'd had different people.
Yep.
They had a guy from New Zealand, they had another Aussie guy 1 year, and they weren't happy with them. So they're still searching to try and find somebody that can fill that slot. So it's an audition for the tour, and I'm like Dennis DeNudo going to the High Court of Australia. And you know what it's like when you're nervous? What do?
Yeah.
You talk way too much.
Yeah.
Dribble, 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 dribble. And I spoke way too much. And then dinner that night, I said to the production team, I said, oh, how'd it go? Oh, we had a whole bunch of issues. We didn't get to listen to you. Fantastic.
Result.
Great.
Result.
So I got a second chance. And then, you know what it's like? You don't get much feedback when you work in media roles.
I don't get any.
You either get invited back or you don't.
Sack or promotion. That's the only advice, which does every athlete's head in. When they're like, oh, I'm not getting any feedback. This is a disaster. I'm like, no, this is good.
Because athletes are accustomed to feedback,
this is
right?
Good, yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Here are your numbers. This is your output. This is what we need to do. We need a few more lactic acid sessions.
So true.
Yeah. So then I got no feedback, got in the plane, came back. And then a week later, I got an email inviting me then to go to France in March to commentate on Paris-Nice, which is one of the first big stage races in Europe each season, 8-day race. So I went over and did that, still wasn't sure about the tour, came home 2 weeks later, I got the email, I'm off to the Tour de France in 2007.
Pinching yourself?
Pinching myself, but also this isn't it. This is not the dream. Sure, and I eventually got there, I'm at the tour, And the first day, they said to me, 2007, it's in London, it's a prologue. We're not sure how long you'll be on air for. It might be, you know, 45 minutes, it might be an hour. So I've prepared for 3 hours worth of broadcast. I've got a whole bunch of notes just so as I'm absolutely ready. The, you know, light goes on. I do the hello and welcome, the introduction, set the scene, talk through the course for the day. And then the producer from America, from NBC, which was controlling the whole world feed, after about 45 seconds, Matt Keenan, throw Phil and Paul in 10, 9. I was on air for 45 seconds, Howie.
Was it a sharp 45?
No. It was like the first races in November right. in 1990 at the Northcote Velodrome.
Right. So you hand over.
Yeah.
So people need to understand this. You are, this is not the right expression, but when I used to watch it when you were on, so you'd be like, I'm sorry, Matthew, you'd be like the fluffer pony. Like you,
correct.
You get yourself to a certain point. So I presume that's what starts to happen. You get to the long stages, the 200 plus K stage. So you do it by yourself.
Yes.
So
the most boring part of the stage.
So when not much is happening, Matt is in the commentary box by himself before handing over to the big guns.
And now Tony Martin goes to the front. He's been sitting the wheels whenever they've been on the flat road or on the climb. But on this narrow descent, the best option for Tony Martin is to go to the front so he can clearly see the line that he needs to take. Rafael Micah is full of confidence and is sitting tightly behind Tony Martin. Meanwhile...
So how long does that run for?
Depends on whether the stage is entertaining or not.
Oh, so when it gets good, the big boys come in.
Correct.
So if it's crap, they just sit back.
Stay there a little bit longer.
Oh, come on, Phil.
Counter-attack, but you know, at the moment, if you get this, is Fabio Aru is going from the front. Last desperate moments here to try and stay in touch with a flyaway British rider up front.
That looks like a response, though, Phil, coming from Nairo Quintana. 1 kilometre to go now for Chris Froome, and he will knock this off at around...
So nothing's happening. I'm all good to go. Crosswind, a few crashes, the attacks are on. Over we go, handing it to Phil and Paul. So I just did all the boring stuff.
And how long is that typically?
Oh, some days it might be 10 kilometres. Yep. Other days it was 80. And then there was a group of people that started...
So you could do 2 hours...
I could do 2 hours...
On your own.
On my own.
So, Matt, what do you think about this? Well, Matt... Well,
funny you say that, because I'm in the shadow of Phil and Paul, yep. The great combo, iconic. And then I'm doing it by myself, the boring part of the stage, and, you know, the feedback I'm getting is, you're not conversational enough.
It's only one bloke in the box.
I'd be more concerned if I was conversational, Howie.
That is the end of Matthew Keenan Part A. Plenty more stages to go on Part B. See you there.